Welcome to the Scaling Japan podcast. I'm your host, Tyson Battino, and on today's episode, we have David McDonald. He is the founder and CEO of DJ Mac, which provides corporate consulting and advisory, especially for global businesses and intercultural business challenges based on his experiences working at Docomo, Disney, YouTube, and Warner Brothers, all in Japan and in Asia Pacific. He also serves on the board of a major corporation called Kadokawa Corporation as an outside director. In today's episode, we're going to talk with David about his experience as one of the first executives at YouTube in Japan and Asia, and how he led the team that scaled the creator economy in Japan and the region. He started with a team of five and grew it to over 50 people in 5 years, enabling tens of thousands of YouTubers that you are definitely familiar with and other businesses to survive and thrive. And yeah, David, you've done quite a lot. Anything that we possibly missed?
No, first, thank you so much, Tyson, for the invite today. It's great to talk to you and your listeners. Thanks for the intro. I think you covered all the highlights of the career, and I'm sure we'll get into more details as we go.
So my first question before we dive into the stages is, could you explain a little bit about what the creator economy is?
Sure. So I think this is a term that's become popular in more recent years. Going back 10, 15, 20 years, the creator ecosystem or the creator landscape was really a lot of professionals. So you had movie producers and directors and TV stars and that sort of world. And since, the founding of services like YouTube and more recently TikTok and Instagram and others, you have this whole world of new young creators who really are, for the most part, independence, right? And so we talk about the creator ecosystem, especially with regards to YouTube in the business I was operating. It's really about all those YouTubers, all those other people who work on the platform to either make a living or communicate a message and really just entertain people.
Cool. And I guess I had one more question before we dive deeply into the stages, but what do you think was kind of your special sauce or competitive advantage?
Yeah. So again, this is a bit of a history of YouTube, a history of YouTube in Asia as we go. And of course, the lucky thing I think we had as a group when I joined the company was the backing of Google. Because I joined the company just about a year and a half, 2 years after the acquisition of YouTube by Google, just to be able to scale on a global basis, right? So while we were very much focused on the local business and how to grow that business, having the backup and support of a global organization really helped.
Cool. So yeah, let's dive into stage one. So I guess first is, how would you describe stage one?
So I joined the YouTube team, as in the introduction, but one of the first sort of executives or managers in 2009. And if you think back, even outside of Japan in 2009, what YouTube looked like, it was in the U.S. A service that was called A Bunch of Dogs on Skateboards. Here in Japan, for some reason, we had no dogs really on YouTube, but it was full of cats. It was a great platform for cat videos. The beginning of 2009, the biggest YouTuber we had in Japan was a cat called Maru.
I've heard of that cat.
Yeah, who had about 50,000 subscribers at the time. I think he's got about 500,000 or more now. But that was our biggest star. And so when you think about where we began at YouTube, first from the creator ecosystem perspective, it wasn't a lot of human creators. It was more humans behind the scenes with things like pets and other types of videos. At the same time, we also had a bit of a challenge because YouTube was not really an accepted platform by more the traditional media world. So we had to operate carefully on one hand, but also respect the copyright of broadcasters and film studios and others. And that meant a lot of process around taking down videos and responding to requests, etc. So the first step really was to get a good sense of the landscape and really what challenges there were to address and tackle, I think, is how it all began.
I actually still remember those days in the beginning. Maru was super huge.
Well, and despite the fact that that he was a cat, it was one of the very first YouTuber brand deals where I can't remember which broadband service it was, but one of the diving in the box videos was used for a broadband service promotion on TV as a commercial. And so it was one of the very first sort of brand deals that a YouTuber got was actually, you know, done by a cat. But, you know, when I came on board, you know, we talked about the number of team members in the beginning. I think just across Asia, folks who were focused only on YouTube were very few. I think about five of us at the time. Because we were part of a broader Google organization, we shared resources with the broader Google team, meaning that people who did partnerships worked a little bit on YouTube and a little bit on something else. But the YouTube sort of core team was about five, six people. And one of our first missions was just stabilizing the business. That is, watching out for policy concerns in market, in country, watching out for, you know, user concerns around how content's being used or uploaded, and also just copyright and sort of ad violations in the early days. And then the next stage was, okay, how do we actually build a business from this?
Gotcha. I think even at the time as well, people were kind of like, you know, is there really a business model to videos?
Yeah. So, and frankly, at the time, there wasn't. So while the concept was there, while the aspiration was there, it took a while to build the momentum, both in terms of the volume of content, then therefore the volume of users or audience that would attract the volume of in that case, yen from advertisers mainly, but also, you know, other types of monetization down the path. So we had to really focus on first how to build the audience base. And in order to build an audience, you need to have the right content. So our first step was really how to develop that content, you know, ecosystem, right? And where to start. And that was the first challenge we had to tackle with the team.
Gotcha. Because I think you said that one of your advantages was that you actually had insights into local market preferences. But could you tell us more about that?
I mean, YouTube, even then, was a big company, big organization. We had offices and teams in, of course, the US and headquarters, and also in Europe and in Asia, sort of scattered about. I mean, mainly in Tokyo in those days, but scattered about. And being a big global organization, like many big global organizations, and some of your listeners, I'm sure, have experienced this, and many who haven't yet will do so in the future. When you have a large corporation or a large company, where, especially if it's based elsewhere in the US or Europe, sometimes the localization or the understanding of what has to be done for the local market is not always fine-tuned. To give a more concrete example, in the early days of trying to build a YouTube creator base, what was working very well in Europe was approaching small to medium-sized companies that had video that could potentially be thrown up on YouTube. So it was companies with, you know, large DVD libraries. And in the European context, there was a large number of companies who were sitting on libraries of video content. It wasn't really being used. In the Japanese context, while we were sort of given the orders to go find those content providers and try and attract them to YouTube, what we ended up finding out was, you know, in that, what we used to call the torso of the business, there weren't a lot of content providers who had enough video to really provide enough to get going. Most of the content, at least in video, was held by broadcasters or studios or other players in the value chain. When we looked at the different models in the different markets, we saw that naturally in the US market over the first few years of YouTube, we had sort of this YouTuber ecosystem develop where, you know, some of the early YouTubers, you know, Freddie Wong, Michelle Phan, and some of the other, you know, big hits of the era, were able to basically organically grow their audiences on YouTube, become, you know, biggish creators for the time. And so we said, okay, how do we then go in a Japanese context, get that jump started. Because what we were finding, of course, in Japan's case, unlike the US, was there's a bit of a reluctance to put your face out and sort of get on camera, which is maybe a bit more of a Japanese cultural trend. Yet at the same time, we knew there were some YouTubers out there that were ready to be tapped into and actually grow the ecosystem. From about 2010-11, you know, we did a much more, I guess, aggressive or programmed approach at how do we go find YouTubers and how do we go talent scout them, I guess, is the first thing, and then help develop their channel, help give them the right advice to get started. And then we'll talk about a little bit later on how to scale their channels, which then help scale the overall business. And so, you know, while I can't take any credit myself personally for some of these finds, you know, people in my team, you know, were able to find some creators like Hikakin, for example, who today is one of the top stars still, and you know, has TV deals and others. You know, he was a beatboxer with a small channel, about 10,000 when we first found him, 10,000 subscribers when we first found him. We're able to get in contact with him directly, assign a content manager to his account and to him personally, and just helped to develop his channel in a more positive direction. And that started the ball rolling, so to speak, for the future YouTubers that came after.
This kind of brings up a lot of different questions, but I guess my first one would be like, how did you choose some of the initial YouTubers to partner with?
I think one of the challenges, or one of the things that we thought was a bit of an uphill battle, was how do we sort of crack the reluctance of many, and this looking at the world of Instagram and TikTok and sort of this creator ecosystem today in 2024, maybe surprising or something we forget, but in 2008, 2009, 2010, there are very few people who wanted to put their face out there, at least with a large audience, right? Because they're either you know, culturally sensitive about overextending themselves, let's say, into digital media, or were just shy about it, I guess. And so while we knew that eventually we had to attract more businesses to the platform and more professional creators like film studios and TV broadcasters, etc., in order to get the YouTubers going, we had to really search the YouTube world as it was and find those who were brave enough to put their face out in front of the camera, quite literally. And Japan, you know, I learned this about 10 years earlier when I was working at Docomo and the long-forgotten iMode service, which just celebrated its 25th anniversary last month. But at Docomo, we launched a mobile internet service called iMode. And we had a strategy in the early years, 1998, 1999, with the launch of really going after what we called beachhead content partners. In those days, it was more professional banks and other types of useful content for mobile. But Japan is often very much a follow the leader type of culture, even in business. So in the world of YouTube, we started off with those first beachhead content creators who we thought would inspire others to say, okay, maybe I can do this too.
And that makes perfect sense.
So one of the things that, you know, I'm most proud about some of the work we did back in those days is fast forward a few years now, and you being a YouTuber still ranks, you know, within the top 5 or 10 jobs that primary school students or junior high school students want to do when they grow up, which, you know, in 2008, 2009 was not on the list, of course, right? Well, with Shohei Ohtani, it might be a baseball player again, but in those days it was a baseball player first, but now then it became a YouTuber first. So that was a bit of a shift in the market that, you know, given those beachhead content creators like Hikakin, like some others, we were able to really inspire others to start doing the same thing and offer programs to help them learn how to do it better.
Do you have any other thoughts on kind of like that challenge that you experienced with established media?
It was a bit of a tight rope to walk. And in the early years, my personal focus and the focus of my team was on building the YouTuber ecosystem until it became something that was big enough for the whole company to get, you know, behind and sink its teeth into. in those early years, I had another colleague who managed more of the what we used to call the premium partnerships. Although I think maybe sometimes the tables have flipped now, and the YouTubers may be more premium. But you know, he and his team was responsible for, you know, dealing with broadcasters and other types of more established traditional media. The challenge there, of course, was YouTube was still seen as a bit of a anti-copyright or you know, a platform which was not necessarily respecting sort of the rights of traditional broadcasters. And if you think back on it, these are still the days when Paramount lawsuit against you know, YouTube was still going on in the US, and it was a very different era. And so we had to play this balance of, you know, working with the right beachhead partners there as well. And a lot of those started off with rights groups. So having the right contract in place with JASTRAC, which allowed us to allow creators and music companies on the platform, you know, pay the rights back to the artists as music was being played. And things like that were very instrumental in starting to create the structure or the foundations, I guess. Yeah, the foundations for the future business on more of the traditional media side.
Also, I mean, there was money involved in it, but do you have kind of like any tips or anything that helped with getting those partners on board, even though you were offering them money?
I mean, YouTube never paid for content, right? And which meant that there was no direct transaction between, say, a Hikikin and ourselves. There was just the, hey, we'll help you grow your channel, we'll help you grow your own audience on YouTube, and that will in turn help you monetize better through, you know, more advertising and things like that. While that has later become, you know, more of an incentive for many YouTubers or many content creators to get onto these platforms, in the early days, it was less about the money and more about just a platform for creativity and getting their voice out there to a broader audience. So, you know, Hikikin eventually became, you know, better known for doing game videos and product reviews and things like that. But he started off as a beatboxer, which sometimes we often forget. And so he was, you know, creative with his sort of musical talent and beatboxing talent to start with. But then in order to sort of really grow a bigger audience, the, you know, gameplay videos, the product review videos, which then also could spin into, you know, direct sponsorships with companies and all that, really helped to grow his personal business on the platform and then others. So I think, you know, the money does play a part of it, or did play a part of it, being able to get there at the right stage. But at the same time, a lot of it was just starting off with a platform to, in those days, we used to say broadcast yourself. So that was the original sort of logo or slogan of YouTube, was to broadcast yourself. And so that was the intent of many of the early creators before the money started rolling in.
Hello, listeners. I'm excited to announce my live cohort course to help you increase your sales in Japan. Many foreigners struggle to turn first meetings into second meetings because they lack a sales pamphlet that follows the standard format in Japan. Even if you have a good first meeting, your internal contact will hand over your current sales pamphlet to the decision maker, and they'll take one look and say they don't get Japan. My live 4-session cohort course will teach you how to make a sales pamphlet in English using the standard format in Japan. You will receive a sales pamphlet template, more than 10 examples from Japanese companies, and a lot of feedback, so you can end the course with a sales pamphlet that gets more meetings and therefore more sales. Getting one extra deal will more than pay off the course, so joining is a no-brainer. You can find more details of the course at scalingyourcompany.com/sales-pamphlet. And we'll have a link in the show notes.
I have one more question before you kind of asking about unique insights. Like, when was that turning point where they saw a YouTuber as someone they could sponsor? Was like there a certain number of views, or they started popping on TV? Like, you know, can you kind of guide us to this transition period?
That's a good one. And I'm not sure I have a perfect answer. And I think this evolved over time and is still maybe evolving. First of all, it was a certain level of audience that each creator could secure on a you know, monthly basis with either viewers or watch time or views on their videos, right? So, you know, obviously, especially for advertising, the level of viewership is very important to attract sponsors. And that's part of it. I think the other part of it is also just reputation. And, you know, brands are often very cautious about, you know, with whom do they partner in order to you know, protect their brands and to, you know, avoid brand damage, right? So while a certain YouTuber or partner on the platform may have lots of views or lots of audience, it may not have been appropriate for certain brands to tie up and do sponsorships. So that was sort of a case-by-case basis, I'd say. But I think the platform overall, over the next, again, I joined in 2009, or the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, really started to evolve as a place where it was more accepted as maybe not perfectly safe, but a more of a safe place for brands and for more traditional content providers as well. And that helped to lift all boats, so to speak, when the platform evolved even further. And this might get into the second part of our discussion, but in, I guess, 2012, 13, 14, around there, we started to do a lot more, of course, you know, advertising sponsorships, partnerships for creators as well as with brands. But we also took on a role in helping creators produce their content better. So I shifted slightly in my focus around that time to set up and operate studios. We had a studio in Tokyo, we had a studio in Mumbai, and we actually went on the road across Asia to other cities and partnered with other studios to help creators on the platform learn how to better create and then connect and learn how to do you know, better videos and partner with others as well. And that became sort of a platform for matchmaking traditional media or brands with creators in an environment that was easy for them to produce content and distribute it.
And I think if you had a certain amount of subscribers, they could come in and use your studios as well, right?
Exactly. So unfortunately, there were too many YouTubers to be able to open the door to everybody, but you know, we had sort of a subscriber threshold and made certain allowances in certain cases. But they could come in, they could book time in the studios, they could basically, you know, quote unquote rent, but really it's free access to equipment. We didn't provide crew and staffing for their productions, but we had, you know, operational crew on staff at the studios that could help them you know, get coached on certain things. And so it was really part educational facility to help creators learn better. It was part actual production facility that allowed to use the studios and equipment and sound, lights, and action, so to speak, to do better content. And then the piece that I was most proud of was the connect piece. So again, YouTubers to YouTubers, but also YouTubers to other either brands, as I said, or traditional media companies. So one of my, you know, proudest moments is we did a partnership in 2014, I believe, with Toei, the film studio, and especially with Toei's Kyoto studio lot. And I don't know if you've been to Kyoto and their studio lot, but they have a back lot, which is all set up with, you know, Japanese Jidaigeki period sets and props, etc. And we did a partnership with YouTubers basically doing Jidaigeki inspired content, not necessarily, you know, drama or lots of sword fighting, but it could have been music videos or even makeup videos and others. And that matchmaking of, you know, traditional media with YouTubers was a great way of sort of bridging that gap between the two and helping both the YouTubers and the brand, or in this case, the studio, get a bit more awareness and address a different audience.
One of the unique things I kind of see with your experience is that you had multiple different types of, let's say, I'm using quotation marks, but customers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's kind of a unique story. And so I guess you've covered a bit, but or how did you kind of like split your time?
We talk about flywheels and we talk about sort of getting the flywheel going, right, and started. And so it was kind of a careful balance between, you know, content and content creators, which then, you know, begot users and audiences, which then of course attracted more advertisers and sponsors and other business partners. So, you know, really it's a balance of all three. But I think, you know, we needed to really start with content, whether it be the YouTubers who came earlier on or later the broadcasters, the film companies, the music labels, etc. And then that would help, you know, grow the audiences. And at one point, you know, there was about a 6 month, 1 year period where, you know, YouTube, like many global organizations, has no one leader in Japan, for example. But we had a number of different teams that are reporting offshore to our different, you know, headquarters in either London or New York or, you know, LA or San Bruno in San Francisco. But then we needed to sort of horizontally tie the team together. So for about 6 months to a year at one point, I was sort of the horizontal chairperson to really get the team going in the same direction. And in those years, we were really focused, that time we were really focused on, okay, how do we get the number of users to a certain point that would make the platform as competitive with Yahoo, for example, or others, especially for brand marketing. And that was the big focus, I think, around 2016, 17, was how do you get, you know, to a point where we'll hit that tipping point and we're now considered as, you know, big media and big mass media. And luckily that happened around that time, a little bit after that. And we were able to attract a lot more brand advertisers with much bigger dollars, which then fed the content ecosystem. And again, as a flywheel, it worked well around the table.
Gotcha. Because one reason I asked this question too is I mentioned that my, you know, Ski in Japan podcast gets around 250 to 500 downloads per episode.
Yep.
But I wanted to kind of think of a way where I could get to 1,000, 2,000. For me, like the number 2,000 is just kind of a random number. Mm-hmm. It's I don't have any like hardcore evidence on it. But in my case, I just picked the number 2,000. And I assume that would be kind of like the takeoff point. Just seeing what I'm seeing with 250 and 500, that, you know, a lot of people have already heard of me, but like, oh, at 2000, it might get really, really interesting. Yes. Like, so how do you kind of go about thinking about how much content do we actually need?
Yeah, I've been away from the YouTube business for a number of years now, and I went back into the traditional media business, as we talked about when I went to Discovery as the general manager here in Japan that merged with Warner about 24 months ago. But thinking back on those days and sort of the basic rules of thumb we had, as well as I think even today with some of the other platforms out there, which are all equally useful for growing a content audience. You know, we used to use, in many cases, the landmark or the milestone of about 10,000 subscribers, because that felt like you were starting to get to a point where you had a regular audience. If you did a regular set of uploads or updates to your channel, we often would push creators to do daily updates, but I think that became just unsustainable for many creators. And so I would always err on the side of fewer but better updates and better videos with a larger audience base that would maybe tap into those on a monthly basis versus a daily basis. But 10,000 was always kind of our tipping point, I think. And from there, we saw then it would exponentially scale to 100,000, a million, etc. So, you know, getting the first 10,000 on YouTube was always the first hurdle. And that's why we often pegged the access to the YouTube studio, YouTube space at 10,000. And if you hit that mark, you're ready for the next stage, which was, okay, how do you get to 100,000? How do you get to a million and sort of accelerate to the platform? Having said that, that was YouTube, which is a big platform with lots of videos, and Discovery is a challenge and that sort of thing. In your case, Tyson, I mean, I'm not necessarily a consultant anymore on influencer marketing and content marketing, but I would say that when you have a more specific message on a tighter platform, as you said, 2000 might be the right tipping point for you versus 10,000 we saw on YouTube.
Yeah, I think that was kind of like one of your unique insights was the importance of localized content and supporting the creators. But
well, yeah, maybe I'll riff off that a bit more if that's okay. So, I think one of the things that YouTube was and is great for is it provides local creators an opportunity to create local content, so to speak, and also talk to a local audience. But depending on the creator and their aspirations, they can also reach a global audience. And so in some cases, we had creators from Japan, but more broadly across the region, who were reaching audiences that weren't just in their backyard, but maybe the US or elsewhere in Asia and other places. So not as many direct Japanese cases, because often the content was in Japanese and there are, you know, bigger hurdles or barriers. to more global access to the, that content. But take, you know, another example of an English speaking country, Australia, and you see this in some of the reports that come out, you know, out of Australia now. You know, Australian content in a traditional world is regulated by, you know, the number of hours you can have that's on TV, for example, that is, you know, Australian made or Australian content versus not. And what we were able to prove was actually having YouTube as a platform for Australians, Australian creators, meant that they could easily tap into a global audience, whether it be in the US or the UK or elsewhere in the world. And we saw that from all across Asia. And in Japan, we had the same kind of cases as well from time to time.
Yeah, what are some of the adaptations you had to do?
I think the finding the right kind of partners in the Japanese context, meaning, and even helping understand headquarters back in the US or back in London or whatever, understand those differences. So, you know, we would talk today about VTubers and sort of that whole movement of digital YouTubers, right? And how they exist on YouTube as a platform, but other platforms as well. That was a phenomena which was very hard for others in the world to really kind of grasp. And it really began with Hatsune Miku and, you know, the popularity of her as a platform as much as content, right? And that was something that was very unique and a focus of ours in Japan, which of course was not a focus of others around the world. And so we had to often bridge that gap with headquarters and say, well, you know, in Japan, it's a little bit different because here's a big trend. And oftentimes understanding those trends was a challenge when you don't see it every day on your screen. And so being able to focus on the local trends at the right time was very important. And, you know, we watched not just, you know, what's happening on YouTube, but what was happening on other social media and SNS sites or social media networks in Japan. You know, we watched Nico Nico as another site with great content and great creators. We watched other platforms as well developing at the time to understand, okay, what types of trends could we focus on in Japan that would help to break the model and not just be a copy of what YouTubers did in the US or in Europe, but something a little bit more unique.
Cool. No, I think that's a good case study in, let's say, adapting to the local market.
And just to kind of further riff off that a bit more. So, you know, you talked in the introduction about the team growing from about 5 to 50 in the years I was there. So we started off with a very, you know, small, tight core team, which you know, focused on, first of all, the operations, just making sure things were running smoothly. And then we started to scale, as I said, into the YouTuber community. Then as the service got bigger, as we looked to hire more people, one of my personal passions was to find people who are passionate about the platform. And so, you know, the hires that came after the first five, all of them, and many of them are still there today, some have moved on to other things, but really had a real passion for A, content, B, creators on the platform or creators in other platforms, and C, in some cases, of being creators themselves. And so when I looked for people to join the team and help, you know, drive the business forward, it was really having that passion and closeness to the content. And so we had people who had written scripts and who had done comics and animation, well, more manga, I guess, rather. We had people who were much more versed in producing content as directors or film producers or, you know, short-form film producers. And we brought in people with that type of profile who really were closer to the creators in order to help drive the overall business forward.
It's kind of related, but I think one trait of having a good leader in an organization is that they develop the future generations of the organization. So the fact that, let's say, the people in your team jumping into either staying in their role or jumping into higher roles.
Yeah, I tried to stay humble, especially as I get, you know, older and more mature in life. But I think you're right that whether I was a contributor or not, a lot of the folks who are on the team in those days with certain, you know, roles have gone on to much bigger roles within the YouTube team here in Asia, or as I said, to other organizations in fairly, you know, good roles in on other social media platforms or other places. So that's one of my things that makes me proud, is not just the business itself growing. And I think, again, to think it started with a cat and today it's, you know, quoted to be about a $4 billion, $5 billion creator ecosystem here in Japan alone. You know, it's the team that grew around it, and probably now, well, when I left, it was about 50, but, you know, with the people who left and came over the years, is probably, you know, easily 100, 200 people who have passed through the doors, so to speak, who have gone on to bigger and better things. And that's also something that's made me proud over the years.
So I think one thing you mentioned was people who are passionate about the platform, but do you have any mm-hmm. other insights for those listening who are kind of wondering who's the right people to hire from the 5 to 50 stage?
Yeah. As I said, I think one of the keys is, of course, having people with the right core skill sets and ability to sort of adapt and adopt different, you know, ideas and ways of working, etc. You know, when you have a platform like YouTube or other sort of B2C businesses or others, again, that closeness to the platform and having some real relationship when it comes to having been a content creator yourself or doing that yourself as a hobby or others is, in other forms, is really important. I think, you know, especially when you're working for a multinational company in Japan, one of the biggest challenges and one of the things I'm trying to do myself post my corporate career, so to speak, is to, you know, focus on those intercultural differences and how to bridge the gaps between, you know, a team sitting in Japan or in India or in Singapore and maybe headquarters in, you know, LA or New York or London. And the natural and understandable gaps in cultures that make, you know, business, you know, businesses challenging and understanding the local market challenging. And so, you know, the team that was that sort of joined around me over those years, I think a lot of them may have been Japanese or Korean or, you know, Indian at heart, but they were able to really step forward, lean in, lean out as the case, you know, may be or when required, to really help bridge that gap culturally and be good ambassadors and good bridges to headquarters in the US or elsewhere in the world when we grew the business. So I think looking at it as, you know, someone who's managed a lot of multinationals in my career, that ability to really be a cultural bridge, I think is an important thing I look for, you know, as the staff people.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Scaling Japan. In addition to serving as your fine host, I also provide advisory and coaching services to business owners who want to 2x, 5x, and even 10x their business. So stop holding your company and your team and your employees back, and let me help you and your company scale. Find more information at scalingyourcompany.com. Now back to the episode.
And yeah, I think this is a good natural segue to stage two. But mm-hmm. what kind of defines stage two in like some of the focuses or turning points?
I mean, we've talked a lot about this already in the conversation, but I would say that, you know, when, in the case of YouTube, when we hit a certain, you know, point of YouTubers becoming, you know, household names and the more traditional media companies starting to embrace the platform more often and brands starting to lean in, it became the time to really start accelerating the business. And so I think phase two in that case really became a lot more communications, both in terms of marketing and PR, but also developing programs that would help to accelerate in one form or another the business, especially in the content side. And so this in terms of communications, you know, in those years, and I think to some extent it still happens, but, you know, we did events called Brandcast, which would take, you know, a number of top decision makers in big brands, as well as the agencies here, Dentsu, Hakuhodo, and others, bring them to a big stadium and do a bit of a show for, you know, 2 or 3 hours, where it would be a combination of like an upfront in the US for advertising and TV. We would walk them through what's available on YouTube and how to use the platform, but also bring in talent, either, you know, professional talent that they would know from other medium or, well, I still call it professional talent, but more YouTube homegrown talent. And that would sort of be the next phase of, okay, how do you start to scale and communicate what you've already accomplished to a bigger audience. At the same time, you may remember, but we did a number of big campaigns every year where at one stage we were, and actually Hikikin was one of the first members of this campaign. We had, you know, big posters and billboards and, you know, the Shibuya Scramble and things like that to really start taking the YouTubers who we had already grown to a certain point to that next level of household names, and that they would be associated with other talent you see on a billboard next door, right? So that was sort of the next big stage of developing the business once the foundation was established.
Yeah, because in my case, like when I started seeing YouTubers on, let's say, national TV programs where, you know, they have the Talento or the Variety programs, like for me, that was kind of like, oh, you know, it's mainstream now.
Yeah. And it took a while to get there, right? And for the longest time, and still today, I've dabbled in both the traditional media space in my career, as well as, you know, YouTube and the more, you know, I guess we call user generated social media platform, you know, content and others. And, you know, there's still very much, I think, a tradition in Japan, for better or for worse, of what we call the genojin or genokai, which is sort of the quote-unquote professionals, right, of the entertainment industry, and the talento, as you said a moment ago, versus the YouTubers that are actually talent in their own respect, but they just haven't been groomed the same way. And so around the same time that we are starting to promote YouTubers a lot more actively, we're seeing a lot more activity towards brands. There was an ecosystem that developed also to help support the creators of basically, for lack of a better word, of talent agencies focused on YouTube creators. And so one of the biggest ones is a company called UUM, which you might have heard of and know of. But there's others, of course, as well. And they're there to help scale when YouTube couldn't, in theory, you know, YouTuber careers, and help them beyond where YouTube, you know, could go in terms of helping manage brand sponsorships and other types of partnerships for the creator. So that ecosystem developed, you know, alongside of the YouTubers themselves. And so that helped to really scale the business too at a certain point around those years.
So I think now that, let's say, you've made it, you scaled in Japan, it's kind of become normalized or kind of mainstream. I think this is where kind of like your APAC role came into play. But
yeah,
what was the challenges?
YouTube as a user platform was in many markets across Asia already, I mean, as a viewing platform. And through the years from the late 2000s to about 2014, we started to expand the number of countries where the YouTube Partner Program, which was the program underlying the monetization on YouTube for YouTubers in different markets. And so, you know, out the gate, we were already live with the program in Japan and Australia when I joined the team. But then shortly after, we launched, you know, Korea, India, Southeast Asia, and Taiwan eventually. And again, in each market, we had the same challenge we had in Japan. So finding the right talent, internally, that is, to be able to be as passionate as the Japanese team was, and of course the team back in the US and elsewhere, to really help drive the platform. But then B, understanding, you know, the content creators' needs, their differences in Thailand or in Indonesia or in India. And we saw different types of YouTubers develop in different ways in each of these markets. And so back to the earlier comment I made about just being in sync with and in tune to the local market and understanding what works and what doesn't work, we had to do that about, you know, 10, 12 times over for each market as we expanded. You know, I can just think of some cases for India. You know, in the early days of India, kids content was actually quite popular, mainly because it was also very cost effective to produce a lot of animation content focused on kids learning, kindergarten, preschool learning out of India. And that became very big worldwide. But then at the same time, we saw a lot of like homegrown comedians and a lot of homegrown acts in India, you'd say, that became, you know, big on the platform and then, you know, spun out to become bigger with their own production companies and others going forward. So we saw a lot of different types of content that we didn't see necessarily in Japan pick up as well as we develop the business elsewhere.
Also, I'm kind of curious, like, while being in many multiple markets, like you have to deal or you have to collaborate with headquarters, different sectors, but how did you, could you tell us a little bit more about how you managed all those expectations?
Yeah. No, it's a challenge because you need, as a manager, it's important to try and be, especially in Asia Pacific or Asia, you know, a cultural bridge between your local team, global HQ, and really support both sides as equally as you can in order to develop the business in a positive direction. So, you know, you're right that, for example, when let's take the Hatsune Miku example a few moments ago, when the US headquarters doesn't quite understand, well, why are we focusing on, or later, VTubers, right? Why aren't there more, you know, humans up, you know, in front of the camera? The frustration sometimes of the local team, you're just saying, well, why don't they understand? And, you know, some of the team members might have experienced, you know, business in the US or elsewhere. They might have been onboarded because they had more cultural sensitivity, but sometimes you get frustrated as someone on the ground when people don't seem to listen to you from afar. At the same time, your headquarters is saying, well, why isn't the market growing this way? And so one of the challenges of being a manager in a multinational, of course, but it goes equally so in a Japanese company looking to expand globally, is how do you bridge that gap between, you know, the global aspirations of headquarters with the local realities on the ground? And that means often, again, knowing yourself well, but then understanding the cultures and the businesses locally equally well, and then stepping in and out as sort of a host leader to help both sides really come together and cooperate and collaborate for a much better business. In the case of YouTube, for example, we went for a number of years where the focus of headquarters in the US felt like it was really on, you know, Europe and not really on Asia, despite that, you know, the population in Asia, you know, India, Japan, of course, we were not live in China, but elsewhere in the region, it had a much bigger potential of audience size. And at the time, Google was focused on the next billion users, right? And the next billion users would obviously come from places like India. And so getting the team to sort of shift their focus from a European market that they understood better because it looked more like a US market to them, to a much more challenging, perhaps, an unknown Asian market was the challenge. But then once we sort of set the case up for them and presented the case, and, you know, at the time, for example, Japan was the second biggest market for video advertising worldwide after the US, and so even bigger than China at that time. Just those simple stats reminding people of the scale of the business opportunity in Asia. And if you lean in and understand a bit better the local cultures, the local nuances, will do well. Eventually, you know, got the focus of the head of our content business, Robert Kinsel, came out a number of times to join us to do different activities and meet with partners. And eventually, you know, the CEO of YouTube at the time, Susan Wojcicki, you know, made a trip out too, and it was a great hit with the press and with us and with partners. And so that sort of getting the team from the US to lean in to the market while the team on the ground understands the gaps and helping them come in is really important.
Yeah, sometimes just getting that CEO to come over makes a huge difference.
Yeah, for the business, but also for the team. And that's an important thing we can't forget, is how when the boss comes to town and is focused on your market, how that becomes a motivational factor for the team members, even when the boss leaves.
For me, some of the takeaways from this interview, I guess the big takeaways is, one is just really identifying what the beachhead is, where to kind of start to get the most impact. And the other ones, it's also just kind of understanding that it takes different strategies for different areas and taking the time to get to know that.
Yep.
And I'll say the other one is, to make yourself a success, you have to make your customers a success as well.
Yes. I think that last one's a good one. That, I mean, we talked again about the flywheel, right? So if the content providers provide more content, the audience then grows, then the, you know, advertisers want to join, and then the content providers can provide more content. So again, making the different stakeholders in that case, in that model, as happy as they can be, I think is important.
Yes, I think that's, for me, that kind of big way, kind of like a master class in a way of how to deal managing multiple stakeholders, and in your unique case, having different customers, the content creators, the listeners, but also you know, the media side as well, and
yes,
advertisers. I think that makes it a unique business, actually. And I guess my last question will be, so what's next?
What's next? So first of all, again, thanks for the invite today. And I hope I didn't bore you and the audience with kind of a history lecture or history story about YouTube in Japan. It's a while ago since we began that journey in 2008-09, but I think a lot of it is still relevant to today. What's next for me? You know, I established my own consulting firm last year. A lot of my passion is around helping companies, as I said before, bridge that cultural gap. And so whether it be consulting or advising or just working on global business plans and execution of those plans, working with either big corporates or small startups on both ends of the spectrum, doing a lot of that sort of advisory and consulting work. And so I'm enjoying working with a few large Japanese companies looking to expand more worldwide. At the same time, I'm working with some very small startups as well, going both ways. And so helping people understand the cultural challenges of business, but also the intercultural challenges of personalities and how to work in the workplace is important. And those are the two things I'm focused on sort of from a consultant and an advisory perspective.
Excellent. And I actually have one company in mind that I will introduce that might need
your help. Great. I would love to. And if any of your listeners want to hear more, I'm happy, of course, to spend some more time.
Thanks so much, David.
Yeah, thank you.